What up, everybody? Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. It is always a blessing when you stop by the house to spend a little time with me and my company, to have a conversation, listen in on a conversation, hopefully pick up a few life points that you can take with you into the world. And I think today's conversation is going to be one where there will be many life points that you will be able to take away from this conversation. This is a brother that when I first met him, and it is an interesting gathering story for the two of us, how we were brought together over a little barbershop radio conversation that we had many years ago. Arsalan Iftikhar is one of the leading voices and legal minds in the space that we know around human rights. He is just an incredible human rights lawyer, global media commentator, and now the author of a book, which we're going to get into, Fear of a Muslim Planet, Global Islamophobia and the New World Order. He is also a National Advisory Board member for the John C. Danforth Center for Religion and Politics at Washington University in St. Louis. But more than anything else, he's the guy that I honestly call a brother and a friend. And man, it is such a blessing and a treat to have you come in for a conversation today.
Michael Steele, it is an honor to be here with you, brother. It's I look forward to this this jogged on amnesia and lean and looking forward as well.
Yeah, no. Well, let's start so folks can understand how we set our table.
Yep.
You and me. Before we get into this incredible read, and I think a profoundly important read in light of everything that we see happening around us, from the pandemic to Afghanistan. And other things in the world. We were invited many years ago to come on an NPR program that, you know, basically a barbershop conversation with a bunch of brothers sitting around.
It was literally called the barbershop.
And we just connected and we clicked and started the conversation there and continued it ever since. One of the things that struck me about your approach was how open you were, and how vulnerable at times you would put yourself in conversation. There were no walls, there was no false, you know, attributes or, you know, beating of chest. It was just this honest, you know, real kind of assessment of a truth that was there for you and that you were trying to get others to see. And that's one of the things that I really appreciate. We were kind of laughing before we started this conversation about, you know, keeping it real. And we're two brothers who get in trouble keeping it real.
Yeah.
So this journey for you, as I've had the privilege of witnessing from time to time, has always been personal, but it's interesting. In your new book, Fear of a Muslim Planet, you start off, and I want to jumpstart our conversation with how you introduce us to your thinking. Quote, somehow I have to remind myself that it isn't personal. This is the strange but unavoidable conclusion that looms back at me through the lens whenever I try to examine the fear and mistrust the world's 1.7 billion Muslims arouse in so many populations today. People are afraid of Muslims. Of that, they are absolutely certain. They will tell you this quite directly. They are convinced that Muslims are worth fearing for very good reasons and that everyone else should be afraid of them too. But which Muslims? Why? Why them and not others? Here, the respondent hesitates and wavers, even though their resolve does not. A remarkable thing has occurred in the past few decades. People have realized that to be afraid of Muslims, they do not have to be afraid of a specific person, ideology, or even a specific thing. It is enough for them to declare that Muslims as a whole are not to be trusted, are to be feared. Specific examples are not necessary. Facts just get in the way. It's not personal. It's a generalized fear. It is enough to simply be afraid. Why did you write that?
I wrote that, Michael, because of the fact that this has been going on since time immemorial. My second book was actually entitled Scapegoats. And I actually very deliberately entitled it Scapegoats because, as you well know, scapegoats is a biblical term, right? It is from the book of Leviticus. It has been around since time immemorial, about the high priest laying all of society's ills on the head upon one goat and letting him loose into the wilderness. And what that shows to me as a human rights lawyer, but also a man of faith, is the reminder that in the history of human existence, we have always had to have the quote unquote other to cast all aspersions on, right? So obviously, if you look at history, we have, you know, the Holocaust, the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, the Jim Crow era. And what I'm talking about now in terms of this rise in global Islamophobia is that we happen to be that next chapter in that otherization history of the human race, and that tomorrow it'll be somebody else after us, right? So that generalized fear, it's that famous, you know, quote from Pastor Martin Niemöller, the first that came from the socialists, and I didn't speak out because I was not a socialist. And it's about the need really to give a damn about people who are different than us, because one day they're going to come after us. And that's the thing, is that we have to remember that, you know, that we have 7.9 billion people on the face of the earth today, and that we're one human race. And we are now, we're now entering, as you know, Michael, into this sort of millennial tribalism that is sort of a reversion of seemingly human history in terms of, you know, sort of, even though we're becoming more diverse as societies in terms of sort of the demographics, sort of the entrenchments in terms of right-wing ultranationalism in every part of the world. So it's not just the United States, but in Europe with the rise of Marine Le Pen in France, or Geert Wilders in Holland, or Viktor Orban in Hungary, even to places like India with the rise of Narendra Modi and the right-wing movement there. And look at China and Myanmar with ethnic cleansing and genocide that's going on, Central African nations. It's really disconcerting to me, obviously, as a human rights lawyer and a human being, that we're entering into this millennial tribalism, whereas we should actually be entering a time when the global village is shrinking and that we should actually be seeing the commonalities in each other. And so we're the fork in the road. And I am trying to persuade people in one direction, I guess.
Yeah, no, you say something there that I think is pretty interesting. And I think for me, at least in my assessment of these things, is a germinating seed, seedling for a lot of what we've seen play out across the globe. And that is this idea of the globe shrinking, the fact that our worlds are coming closer together.
Yep.
Other was safely other because they were over there. Even on the European continent, they didn't have to worry about those folks from Africa so much. We can go conquer them. And when we place ourselves amongst them, that's our choosing. But when they choose to come to be amongst us, now, wait, hold up, time out. Wait a minute.
Let's pump the brakes there.
Yeah, let's pump the brakes about now. Now, this whole thing doesn't flow both ways. So this idea of a shrinking globe, I think without directly saying that, in Fear of a Muslim Planet, really quintessentially kind of gets at the nub of it. You in the very beginning, write about the 2019 New Zealand mosque massacre by white supremacists who, you note, quote, terrorist who live streamed the attack had posted a manifesto online in which he was clearly obsessed with the idea that non-white immigrants to New Zealand were having more children than white New Zealanders, and slowly creating demographic change. Yet after lodging this general complaint, the author, this white supremacist, seemed unable to say exactly why it was a complaint at all. Then you go on and you ask the question, why should it be a bad thing if the number of Muslims in New Zealand increased slightly? The white supremacists had no answer. Why is it bad when Muslim people go to live in Christian majority countries, but not when Christians go to live in Muslim majority countries? Consider, for example, all the British expats in Dubai. That really is, at the end of the day, the heart of this thing is, we're fine as long as you're over there. And if we want to be with you, we will come and freely choose to be amongst you on our terms. But it's not, this street doesn't work both ways. You just don't get to drive up in the neighborhood and park.
So it's basically what you just talked about, Michael, is assimilation versus integration, right? And we'll talk about that a little bit also. But just to give some context, in March 2019, a 29-year-old white supremacist from Australia, whom I choose not to name both here and in the book, walked into two mosque locations in Christchurch, New Zealand, and proceeded to massacre 51 innocent Muslim worshipers as they prayed, men, women, and children from all over the world, black, white, and green, as he live streamed it live on a webcam on his helmet on Facebook Live. He left behind a manifesto which is entitled The Great Replacement. And that's actually what you're talking about. And is really one of the central themes of my book is The Great Replacement Conspiracy Theory, which is a central ideology in the global white supremacist movement. And really what it is exactly what you said, is that basically that in any context, white supremacists can say blank kind of people are coming to replace us.
Right.
Right. So in the American context, it could be Latinos coming from the border, coming to replace us, Muslims, refugees coming from Afghanistan. It's literally a fill in the blank. And in the European context, it's similar in that jargon. So it's basically, Michael, it's become the grand unification theory for white supremacists. So basically they can just literally copy and paste whatever minorities they don't like and say, we're targeting you because of this. And the three cases that I highlight in the first chapter of the book to illustrate how we as allies need to stand up for each other is, number one, obviously the Christchurch massacre.
Right.
But the second one is the Tree of Life synagogue shooting massacre in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where 11 Jewish congregants were massacred by an anti-Semitic terrorist. And of course, what the irony there was is he also left behind a racist manifesto that also cited the Great Replacement Theory. And what was the first line of his manifesto? He said, open your eyes. It's the filthy, evil Jews bringing the filthy, evil Muslims into this country. So basically, he got a twofer there.
He got a twofer.
He was attacking. He used the roundabout way. He was running an end around on attacking Muslims by attacking a secondary minority. The third case, this really boggles my mind. A year after that, in El Paso, Texas, at a Walmart superstore, a white supremacist walked in and massacred 22 Latinos and Hispanics in an act of anti-Latino terrorism, which I read about as well in the first chapter. And he also left behind a manifesto. And he actually said that the Christchurch mosque shooter was his inspiration and that his massacre was in response to the Latino-Hispanic invasion of America. So in 1 minute here, I've talked about three different minority groups, Muslims, Jews, and Latinos, who've all been attacked because of the same one dumbass conspiracy theory, Great Replacement Theory, that is being perpetuated now all over the world. It has been mentioned by politicians like Donald Trump and Matteo Salvini in Italy. Tucker Carlson now freely talks about it on his nightly show, on Fox News.
Every night, if he can help it.
This is not dog whistle. These are fucking bullhorns.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is not, we're past dog whistles now. This is like billboard size. Hey, pay attention to this. Yeah. We want you to know that white people are superior. It's interesting though, you referenced this idea of assimilation versus integration.
It's a one-way versus a two-way street.
Right.
You keep saying the two, and it really, you know, when you look at a lot of white, white European or American politicians, when they talk about immigration, they talk about sort of, you know, how how you know how we can you know acclimate folks into this into our society. They talk about assimilation, right? So they basically, assimilation is a one-way street where they want brown and black people to become like the majority white people, right?
Right.
Integration is a two-way street where people get to maintain their identities and government has to do stuff for the people also, right? It's not just the majority rules. You know, you're coming to our home, you got to act like us, sort of thing. And so it's really as somebody who's dealt with European governments and American governments when it comes to these issues. You know, I always frame things in an integration model, and we push back on things. You know, when people, you know, for example, in Europe, the hijab bans, the headscarf bans that have been going on for 15 years, Jacques Chirac in 2004 launched them. These white people are obsessed with what Muslim women wear, right? So much so that they don't even allow brown Muslim women to wear full body lycra suits, known as burkinis, on beaches because it offends French morals. It does not offend French morals any more than seeing a middle-aged white man's butt crack in his Speedo on the French Riviera. Like this intellectual dishonesty, Michael.
Oh my God, you just gave me an image I can't get out of my head.
My job is to highlight the double standards, right? As a human rights lawyer, you want to make sure that all human beings are treated equally. You don't have a different standard for when white people wear a full body Laker suit because they're just surfers. But when a brown Muslim woman wears it, it's context versus content, right? And so again, if we are going to be even remotely intellectually honest about these global conversations, we have to look inside ourselves as much as we look at others.
That then begs the question for me, because I wanted to not pivot off of, but pivot into a little bit deeper, this idea of assimilation versus integration and how that translates into terrorism versus terrorism. I'll tell you what I'm talking about. So you expertly go through and you compare, you talk about rather the October 2017 killing of 58 individuals and wounding of 500 in Las Vegas by a white man. And you know who, and everyone remembers that killing.
A white man, hold on, who got a hotel suite on like the 15th floor, had like tripods.
Yes.
This was as Jason Bourne as you get. And if it was a brown Muslim man, do you think we'd still be hearing about it today, Michael?
Oh my God, yes.
Damn right, you'd be on
it. You would. You would.
That's a double standard that I'm that's racist.
Well, so you have this scenario where this white asshole goes out, kills 58 people, wounds 500.
500.
500. And then literally a week later, you had the killing of 8 people in Lower Manhattan by a 29-year-old Muslim from Uzbekistan.
Correct.
You know, both of these acts of mass murder were meant to instill terror, which is what they're there for, in the general public. Yet, only one of them was called terrorism.
Can you guess which one?
And in the mainstream, which one? Exactly. All right. Okay, folks, I'll give you three choices, and the first two don't count, right?
Yeah.
Clearly, the one involving the 29-year-old Muslim was beamed across the globe by our American media as an act of terrorism. And I do remember
solely an act of terrorism. Meaning
out of the gate.
Well, no, if they called the Las Vegas dude a terrorist and then they called this dude a terrorist, I wouldn't have said boo, right? Because they're both acts of terrorism. And that's the hypocrisy, right? That is this sort of Western hypocrisy of, you know, of our mainstream media. Like I said, you know, there have been studies by Georgia State University, University of Alabama. I cite several media studies there that acts of mass murder when committed by a Muslim received like 348% more news coverage than that same act of mass murder committed by a white man, right? And so it's that double, I call it the Allahu Akbar double standard of terrorism, right? Mm-hmm. It's like if you look at historically, you know, the FBI says this, every agency says that the vast majority of terrorist attacks that have occurred on American soil in the last 30 years have overwhelmingly been done by white supremacists, right? Not Islamists the way that everybody would make you think that, you know, we're on every street corner, you know, trying to blow shit up. And that is racist. Like, and that then my job is just to call out that racism. It's like, you know, this is something that minority groups have dealt with since time immemorial, and we have to pay as much attention. Okay, January 6th, the insurrection.
Right.
Can you imagine if there were Black Muslims instead?
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Tell me, okay, so
Jim Jordan, all those bitches would have been, they would have been shitting in their pants to this day, screaming about how awful this was. And we need that. Talk about commission. We'd have 20 commissions right
now.
Can
you imagine? So it's September 2nd now, like from January 6th to September 2nd, if there were Black Muslims who stormed the United States Capitol. And tried to
hang the vice president of the United States and kill the speaker of the house.
And most importantly, how many dead bodies would have there have been at that Capitol? How many dead Black Muslim bodies would there have been? There would not have been one Ashley Babbitt. There would have been
hundreds.
A bloodbath.
Yeah.
And it's true. And it's true. And if we as an American society cannot reckon with that in the year 2021, dude, you and I go back over 10 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine so I'm going to pause here for a moment and talk about our relationship in NPR. So one of the great things about, you know, I've now been an NPR commentator for over 14 years, 300 appearances. And I always tell people out of all my media gigs, CNN, BBC World News, Today Show, NBC News, Meet the Press, NPR and NPR Barbershop was always my favorite for a multitude of reasons. And first and foremost, and you can appreciate this because you've been in the game longer than I have, is that the split screen cable news model is trash.
Right.
We operate in the trash because that's, you know, that's what that's what real Gs do. But What NPR as an entity allows with 17-minute long form stories and segments and people from all different backgrounds who can actually sit and discuss and disagree without being disagreeable, right? And keep that humanity and keep the nuance. Like nuance, we've lost nuance as a human race. And so one of the things that I've loved about you from the jump is that number one, intellectual honesty, number two, nuance, and number three, you being a man of faith. And you know me, again, I mean, I've been a Muslim guy for 20 years, and my existence, like what I do is not a job, it's an existence, right? Like they're gonna pull my dead body off the field, I'm gonna leave it all out there, you know, that's just the way I roll, ride or die. But I'm doing it for the love of God and for the love of humanity. And right. That's the thing is that we often forget that although there are so many religions in the world, we know that all rivers flow to the ocean.
Yep.
And we forget that centrality of that, the fact that I always tell people, I'm like, you know what? There are 7.9 billion people on the face of the earth today. I checked before coming on because, again, that's what real Gs do. And it saddens me that in the year 2021, Michael, it was still sad that a pandemic didn't work. So that means that it is still going to take a Will Smith and Jeff Goldblum Independence Day alien invasion for us to finally rally together as a human race and finally be like, oh, yeah, we like there's only 8 billion of us. That's a finite number. That's right. It. That's all that exists. Sentient beings on this planet. And I like the COVID-19 and the pandemic quarantine didn't work. And so like, it's like, we now got to wait for that Will Smith, Jeff Goldblum, Independence Day invasion. And so, you know.
Yeah. How do you bring all of that together in a way that people see the connectedness that we have? I mean, it goes to this idea of, you know, with 8 billion people, yes, the globe has shrunk in the fact that there are a lot more of us today than there were 100 years ago, or certainly 300 years ago. And and yet we seem not more but less connected. And you referenced the great replacement theory, conspiracy theory out there. Is that a reaction to this growth? You know, you have people complain, oh, we gotta, you know, we've got too many people on the planet. It's impacting the environment. It's impacting this. It's doing that. I kind of come from the worldview that, you know, yeah, I think Mother Nature can handle that as long as we are handling our end of the business. Yeah. I think Mother Nature's like, yeah, okay.
She got this.
She got this at the end of the day. The problem Mother Nature has with us is that we're not handling our business. But be that as it may, setting aside those types of arguments, this sense that we need to eliminate other in order to preserve us, that seems to be a more important incentivizer or push than anything else.
So I want to unpack a little bit more about the Great Replacement conspiracy theory's history for your audience, which I think they will find very interesting. So the Great Replacement conspiracy theory is widely generally accepted to have been coined by a 74-year-old French man named Renaud Camus, C-A-M-U-S, no relation to Albert Camus, who still actually lives in a 14th century castle in the south of France. Now, the interesting thing about Renaud Camus and his Great Replacement conspiracy theory, and being a race hustler, is that the only thing that Renaud Camus was ever actually known for of any notoriety in the 1970s, he was actually only known to write gay porn. And I actually said, I want to lean into that shit. And the reason is I want people to see that this race hustler who has no background in anything that's related to genetics or science or, you know, shit that matters, is now peddling this conspiracy theory, not only about Muslims in France, for example. He's actually also talked about black-skinned Africans in France. He's also whined that Jewish people are teaching Frenchmen about French culture on their version of NPR and things like that. So, you know, he's an equal opportunity hater there. But the interesting thing to note is that he still lives freely in a 14th century castle in the south of France, while Emmanuel Macron and the French government have been clamping down on Muslim identity in France, from hijab bans to burkini bans. This is what keeps me awake at night, is the fact that this motherfucker gets to live freely in the south of France, being a race hustler who the Great Replacement Theory, according to the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, which is a British think tank, has found that searches for the Great Replacement conspiracy theory on Twitter in the last 4 or 5 years have gone up from 100,000 to 400,000. Mm-hmm. And obviously with people like Tucker Carlson, you know, amplifying it even more and the like, the cat's out of the bag.
Right.
But you know, we always talk about we need to combat ideologies and this and that, and we bomb the shit out of Muslims, we throw them in jail really quickly for saying and thinking the wrong things. But this motherfucker is living in a 14th century castle, dog. He's living in a castle. That is, first of all, that's some fuck you money.
Right, exactly.
From being a white supremacist, and to the government, what message is it sending to 10% of France's societies that are Black, African, Muslim migrants and their next generations, right? These are the things that are going to keep me awake until the day that I leave this earth.
You, in a number of chapters, hit on topics that are really popping today. And by today, I mean in the last 20 years, going back to 9/11, which we'll be celebrating, I use that word advisedly, of course, commemorating is a better way to put it, commemorating 9/11 this September 11th, 20 years later. But you raise a number of issues in a number of chapters, and I want to touch on those because it really kind of pivots off of this discussion around great replacement and some of the other things we were talking about, particularly with respect to Muslim women and how they're perceived, not just in France but globally. You have chapters starting off. It's entitled, I love the way you set it up, because I hate Muslims. The ideology, you know, it's a quote, I hate Islam, rather, the ideology of retarded culture. And that's from the Dutch politician who you've mentioned, Wilders?
Yeah. Geert Wilders.
Yes. Wilders. And then you have a chapter, Is It Time for Muslims to Leave Europe? And in the end, you conclude, quote, just as diverse Jewish communities were eventually integrated into Europe's social fabric, so too will European Muslims be. This integration will not bring negative impacts for Europe, but will instead enrich European nations in a variety of ways and build on their history of tolerance and pluralism, period, end quote. I understand that sentiment, and that's the heart of my friend who I met many, many years ago. That heart is still beating for the good nature of men and women in the global community. But the reality is closer to, I hate Islam, the ideology of a retarded culture. And how do we go about reconciling ourselves to move into the space that you find that optimism and that hope in the face of some of the things that we've been talking about, you know, the way we perceive a traditional Muslim woman wearing traditional garb, and we try to westernize her by saying, well, she's only free if she's wearing short shorts and a halter top, or just a regular dress, if you will. And how we sort of manifestly categorize the Muslim community through a Western set of values.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we project ourselves, right? That we're human beings. We project our values onto people all over the world. And depending, we're the world's superpower, right? So we're bombing the shit out of countries, then we are projecting our values upon them. And we, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, the list goes on and on.
Right.
And it's that imposition of Western liberal values, you know, the notion of traditional Western liberal, modern liberal values that we impose on folks. Of course, various, you know, even though we ourselves are violating those norms each and every day, both domestically and internationally, like we're as disingenuous and duplicitous about. I mean, if we talk about, you know, the status of women, how about, you know, the domestic abuse rate in America is leagues beyond the domestic abuse rate in a lot of other countries. So like we shouldn't be lecturing anybody on anything, you know, again, but we do that because we're America and we're a superpower. And again, it's when we, the problem. So first of all, you simply cannot be a human rights lawyer if you are not an eternal optimist. Like, I mean, it is the most thankless job in the world. You don't get paid shit because you're standing up for the voiceless, right? You're standing up for the disenfranchised and marginalized folks. But I tell people that we sleep well at night because, you know, we're trying to do something for the greater good. And I think that ultimately, and that's the thing that I want to personify in my life is as a practicing, believing Muslim human rights lawyer, that I'm living my ethos every day, right? So to me, everything is about ethics, basic human ethics. And every river flows to the ocean. In terms of every religion teaches the golden rule concepts of loving thy God and loving thy neighbor, right? And central, that is the centrality, is the love of one divine being and the love of all of their creation. And then that's central. And then we get into the minutiae of, you know, the way we practice and things like that. And so I want to bring the humanity back to everything. And the only way that you're going to change policies, you're going to change minds, you're going to change anything is by humanizing whatever is not humanized, right? Whatever is demonized. So there's, we talk about demonization all the time, but we forget that demonization is one part of the spectrum of humanization.
Right.
Right. And those are key elements. And so I'll tell you a story in terms of, you know, something that people tend to focus on as a negative. I actually saw as a strategic victory. So as you know, I have been on every news outlet in the world. And, I, you know, since 9/11, I have been known as the Muslim guy. Right. And so what I always do, so I'm going to tell you two quick stories to illustrate sort of the issues that I've dealt with. In terms of sort of my own identity as an American. So another thing that people, you know, often forget is that, you know, I am a brown-skinned Muslim man named Arsalan Iftikhar. Mm-hmm. So people automatically assume that I must have been born somewhere else and I immigrated here. So one time I was doing a live nationally televised debate at the anchor desk on a news network that will remain nameless. Mm-hmm. All right, it was Fox News. And as soon as we cut the commercial break, this is back in like 06, 07, I'm sitting across the anchor desk from the anchor, and they're taking off my microphone and my makeup. And while we're on commercial break, the news anchor, she looks over at me and she goes, "That was a great interview that you did. Your accent didn't come through at all. Where are you from?" And I said, "Chicago." And she goes, "No, no, where are you really from?" And I said, "Chicago." And she asked me a third time on the set. She said, "No, no, where are you really from?" And I said, "Chicago." And I walked out of her studio. Now, this woman apparently could not fathom that a brown Muslim man would be able to walk onto her television set, be able to articulate himself in a live 7-minute nationally televised debate without having some sort of stereotypical bobbleheaded accent, right? Her notion of what it meant to be an American did not include me. Right. Because if I was a white guy who came in to give an interview, she never would have commented on how well my interview went or that my accent didn't come through, because people oftentimes look as much at the messenger as they do to the message itself.
Right. That's so true.
But so imagine for an entire generation of brown Americans like myself, I always tell people I was actually born in Norfolk, Virginia. I was actually born in one of the 13 original colonies. So I'm probably more American than most of you who weren't born in Virginia. But imagine, Michael, that on September 10th, 2001, nobody questioned my American identity. And then the next day and ever since.
They did. They have.
That's all I've been doing, homie.
Yeah.
And I've worked for 2 United States senators. I have been a ball boy for the Chicago Bulls. I've done more shit than you have. And that's the thing. But you know what? A white immigrant, you know, comes to this country day two, and because she's white, you know, she gets an American. And so again, like context versus content, right?
And I've actually, it's funny you should say, because I've actually been a part of those conversations with white individuals from another country.
Right.
Who have been in America and have, you know, the accent from where they are or where they're originally from isn't as pronounced. And others in the grouping are shocked that they're actually, when she, in this particular case, would say, "Oh, no, I'm actually from this part of Eastern Europe," or whatever. And
Was her name Melania?
No, right. And to your point, yes, you have a brother born in Virginia by way of Chicago, and people are like, "No, seriously, what country are you from?" The country of Virginia.
Yeah, and so not only, you know, not only that notion of sort of our own identity and ability to identify as Americans, right? So, and it's obviously, it's not, you know, it's one thing that I always like to highlight is that the title of my book, Fear of a Muslim Planet, is first of all, an homage to the very famous 1990 rap album, Fear of a Black Planet by Public Enemy.
Yes.
Which I'm a huge hip hop head. It was sort of one of the formative albums.
Oh, there you go. Another stereotype blown. Jeez. And right? he likes hip hop.
it was the notion back then, you know, that Chuck D was able to see, like, there's this sort of insane conspiracy that the black people are trying to take over the planet. And similarly now, people, you know, people talk about, oh my God, when Republican politicians talk about Islamic Sharia law.
Oh, hold that. No, you were going to get a hold that. I want to save that for.
I'm going to dunk all over them.
Yeah, hold that thought, because that I have a specific way I want to get into that.
All right.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to have more of this wonderful conversation with my main man, Arsalan Iftikhar, and his new book, Fear of a Muslim Planet, Global Islamophobia in the New World Order. We'll be right back.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
All right, folks, welcome back to the Michael Steele Podcast. We're having I hope you find enlightening and certainly informative, but also just good listening to my friend Arsalan Iftikhar, as we talk about his new book, Fear of a Muslim Planet, Global Islamophobia in the New World Order. We started to talk a little, you raised the subject of Sharia law, and I'm going to put a pin there, because before, I think it's important before we get to that,
sure,
to take note of, as I referenced before, this 20-year remembrance of 9/11. And you go back to President George W. Bush, now famously declaring to the American people that this was not a war on Islam, mm-hmm. that this was not a war on Muslims, but this was a war on those who attacked us. And it didn't matter their religion, their dogma, their faith tradition. What mattered was their act. But then you had former President Trump, 18, 19 years later,
right,
saying, quote, "I think Islam hates us."
Like it's an eighth grade bully that stole his lunch money, first of all.
Yeah, yes.
Like he actually personified the second largest Abrahamic religion in the world into a person. I think Islam hates us.
Right. And so that's what I want to get into. So
like where do we live?
Right. How do we go from that moment of humanity and clarity with George Bush? Now, again, no, you know, idea one way or the other about the subsequent war in Afghanistan and Iraq and all of that. But the fact that he stood there, and then even in between, where you had that moment by John McCain pushing back on one of his supporters who was making declarative and racist comments about Barack Obama being a Muslim, and John McCain very definitively, some would say to the detriment of his political ambitions and campaign for president, defending Barack Obama in the way that he did, saying, "No, he's a good human being. He's a good man. He's a good family man."
But you know the interesting,
so where we get to where we are now.
So great question. So let's start with George W. Bush. The question that you actually just asked me, I was actually asked that exact same question by Chuck Todd as we sat on NBC News Meet the Press together with Tom Brokaw at our table. And the answer that I gave on Meet the Press, which you can find on YouTube, is the same one that I'm going to give today. And it's true, is that what George W. Bush said in 2001 about Islam and Muslims, he would be considered a gadfly in today's 2021 Republican Party.
Agreed.
Because it just wouldn't happen. And just, that's why, you know, you and I were catching up before the taping started about the sort of the last 20 years in terms of how far we've come and how far we've gone. And,
right,
and I always tell people, and this context is important, and you're, again, like I said, you're an OG that's been in the game longer than I have, and you'll appreciate the true sort of profoundness of this. You know, when 2001, like when George W. Bush was, then the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, Abu Ghraib, and Guantanamo Bay, and then all of this shit popped off. And when that shit was popping off, as you know, we were at that time, all Americans who were sort of vehemently against George W. Bush, what did every single one of them say? What did every single one of us say? We said, "My God, there is no way that we could have a president worse than George W. Bush.
Right.
And at that time, the whole world would be like, you're damn right. And Donald J. Trump just said, hold my GD beer. That's where we've come, is that I was telling you before, I feel like the world and the human race has reached the absurdity of an Albert Camus novel. And that's the interesting thing. And, you know, the John McCain example that you give is actually multi-layered. And most people actually don't look beyond that, into that second layer, because obviously it's something that we as, you know, as brown and Arab Muslim folks sort of feel intrinsically. Right. So what had happened for your listeners was that at a New Hampshire rally once, there was an older lady who got up during the Q&A session during a McCain rally, and she got on the microphone and she started saying some disjointed things. And at the end, she's like, you know, Obama is one of them, an Arab, right? She said the word Arab, but she obviously meant both an Arab and a Muslim.
Right.
And as you said, John McCain jumped right in and he goes, no, ma'am. I know him and he's a good family man, right? And to the vast majority of Americans, you know, that was a huge hurry moment. And it was. But it also, again, to millions of Muslims around the world, it also, you know, when he said that, again, to us, it sent the message that being a good family man is exclusive from being an Arab or a Muslim. You understand what I'm saying? Is that because we live that experience, you know, it's like, imagine this, when we are framed as like normal human beings, like functional, like putting one leg in at a time, like it's, we're still dehumanized. There's several Pew studies that have come out that showed that Muslims and LGBT folks are the most despised demographic groups in America, writ large, right? And for historically, it was always LGBT group, LGBT folks that were the lowest rung of the totem pole. I think it was in like 2013 that Muslims undertook them.
Right.
So then when you're the most hated demographic group in the Western world for the majority of your adult life, right? I just turned 44 yesterday. For 20 years, you know, that was 10 days after my 24th birthday. I was a second year law student at WashU Law in St. Louis. And I knew from that moment, that day, I was like, nothing in the world is ever going to be the same.
Yeah.
And it hasn't. And I've had to.
Right, it hasn't been.
And so the problem is that we continue to unravel, right? You know, that's the things that when we talk about the global village shrinking, it revolves around the internet, right? The internet can be the disseminator of good. It can be the disseminator of bad memes, you know, conspiracy theories, things like that. And so, you know, that's why we need to give a damn about things that happen half a world away, right? People are like, okay, right. Afghanistan, backwards ass country, end the 20-year war. Everybody, like, nothing's going to happen. Let's just bring it. Like everything matters. The refugees matter. Like the way that we leave matters. Like, everything matters now at a time when we're becoming entrenched in our global tribes all over the world and then demonizing everyone else or attacking everyone else who is different than us in some way.
How then do you see the role for Muslims generally, yes, Muslim Americans specifically, yes, in dealing with these various narratives where you have sort of the Trumpian view, I think Islam hates us, and you're right, he's now taken an entire religion and condensed it down to a person, you know, to the image of a person.
Right.
And yet you have many Americans and I would say globalists, French, the French are no different from this, as you've already alluded to in some of the rather draconian responses to Islam in France, that the terrorism fuse,
yes, sir,
has not only lit the fear component, but it also has lit the response that Muslims don't seem to do anything about it. I've heard this over and over again. I actually even recall, I think, listening to you on a program debate this issue in the past, where the where people feel they don't hear enough from, quote, moderate Muslims to push back against the atrocities that we're seeing now play out in Afghanistan, for example, which again has nothing to do with being a Muslim, but you know, and much more to do about just being Afghanistan and being, you know, all of that. How does that narrative, how does that continue to feed this undercurrent of what you refer to some extent as political Islamophobia, and how that then continues to relight that fuse over and over again that both Bush and McCain, even our current President Biden, have tried to put out before it gets fully ignited?
So the question that you just asked about Muslim condemning terrorism, I was actually asked on another episode of Meet the Press. And I gave the same answer I'm going to give to you today. And I actually, I Googled it while you were asking the question on mute. And I would say, you know, whenever I hear the trope that Muslims don't condemn terrorism, I always tell people that if you type in the words Muslims condemn terrorism into Google, today you'll receive 889,000 results. And so if you don't think that Muslims are condemning terrorism, you don't know how to use a computer, which means that you're not listening, right?
Right.
It's confirmation bias. It is this is the only way to dunk on people is with facts, right? And that's what you say is that this is the fact. And that's what confirmation bias is. When we decide that a certain group of people are a certain way, it is going to take a lot of counter information to change our minds. But like I said, Michael, I think it's all about humanization. And one of the things that I often do and people often comment about is that, and I actually do it for a particular reason, and this story will illustrate this, is that whenever I'm on television, I always make it a point to wear something pink. As you can see today, I'm wearing a pink sport
coat,
a pink tie. And I actually do that very deliberately. Number one, it's because that when people see a brown Muslim man on television, they don't normally associate fashion sense with that profile that they've created.
Right.
So I'll give you an example. I once did an interview on the O'Reilly Factor with Bill O'Reilly early after 9/11. And that video was on YouTube, and there were obviously hundreds of thousands of views. And I remember reading one comment. I just want to read one comment. It was one line comment that this lady wrote that sort of illustrates my point in terms of what I'm trying to do as a human being incrementally. She wrote one line comment. She said, "I did not agree with anything that he said, but I really liked the pink tie that the terrorist was wearing." So now when I say that one line, most people start laughing at the terrorist. But for me, the incremental victory, Michael, was the fact that because she liked my pink tie, I incrementally humanized myself and quote unquote my people to her.
Yeah. So right? is that what we need to do for the American perception of Muslims to be more accurate and kind?
We need allies like you to start saying stuff. We need allies. That's the thing. Is like I always tell people, you know, one of my buddies is Peter Beinart, a columnist from New York Times and editor with the Jewish Currents, and a prominent liberal Jewish intellectual, and he actually goes on television a lot and talks about Islamophobia and how we need to combat it. And when he goes on as a white Jewish ally, it resonates so much more than when I, as a brown Muslim man, go on, because everybody expects a Muslim to do that. Now, on the flip, when I, as a brown Muslim human rights lawyer, go on CNN and condemn anti-Semitism and talk about a synagogue attack in Kansas City when a white supremacist walked in, and I write a column about that, you know, condemning that. But from my perspective, that's going to resonate with the American public more, because they're like, "Oh, this brown Muslim dude is condemning something outside, you know, outside of his zone." And that's what we need to do is be true intersectional allies with one another, right? And honestly, just think about yourself, whatever identity that you ascribe to. You know, if you're a white Catholic male, you know, when you think of things like Islam, you know, we don't want anybody, we don't want any aspect of our identities to be viewed monolithically, right?
Right.
So, for example, has anybody ever made the ridiculous assertion that pedophilia is a central component to Catholicism. Of course not, even though we have seen hundreds and thousands of Catholic priests rape entire generations of young boys and girls around the world whilst in the frock. Nobody has ever made blanket aspersions on Catholicism.
Except Bill Maher. Except my buddy Bill Maher.
That guy too. That's the entire episode on him.
Right.
But the point I'm making is that people are very quick to cast those same blanket aspersions on Islam so cavalierly, right? All Islam believes, just like Trump said, I think Islam hates us. Islam's a retarded culture. Gerd Wilders, when he said that, I'm like, motherfucker, there are 57 Muslim majority countries on the face of the earth speaking every language in the world. Which cultures are you speaking of?
Right.
There are Muslims that look like you with your blonde ass bouffant like Donald Trump. Right? He's Donald Trump of the Netherlands. But that's the thing, is that we allow people to cast aspersions on the world's second largest religion, Michael. Like, I always tell people, one out of every four people on earth is a Muslim. I always tell people that if Islam really told Muslims to take over the world, we would all be dead by now.
Yeah.
Let that sink in. I'm going to say that again. I'm going to pause and say, if Islam told all 2 billion of us Muslims to take over the world in the year 2021, we would all be dead by now. We forget that 8 out of the last 16 Nobel Peace Prize winners were Muslims, right? We forget the fact that most of Western medicine started with the invention of anesthesia in the Islamic world. That's the thing. We are in the sort of white makes right, white is right. It's like if we Western white European people invented it, did it, it's gravy. But, the black and brown folks over there,
that's like I got into a dumbass back and forth with this individual, white individual, who was going on about what white men have done to save the world, et cetera, et cetera. And it got so ridiculous that we got down to streetlights. Yes, it really, and I was like, so you're really not only showing how ignorant you are, but just how generally devoid of any lack of understanding. Since a black man invented the stoplight. And I told him, I said, why he invented the stoplight? Uh-huh. To keep you dumbass white people from running into each other.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
and he just looked at me. I'm like, when you open your mouth, please come prepared to have the conversation, because if you're not, you just need to shut yourself down.
No, but the thing that it shows me more, actually, Michael, is not only that his dumbassery, is that how entrenched he was that he was willing to go down to that level.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, after like 2 or 3 levels, if you push back to someone,
right, you think you'd stop.
If they're an intellectually honest human being, you're like, I just slow my roll, use my slow brain here. That's what I always try to do. Right. If he's going down levels, like if he is literally like if he's that's how entrenched we are as human beings. This whole quarantine pandemic, like it actually makes me more worried about the human race, because we've gone squirrely now. Like, we don't talk to other human beings. We don't know how to interact with people with decency. And like, people are, they're losing their shit at airports and things are popping off everywhere.
The one thing it shows me, to your point, Arsalan, is how far we've come from that rallying moment 20 years ago after 9/11, which utterly was a gut punch to the country.
Yep.
To where we are in 2021 with the pandemic, which was another gut punch to the country.
Huge.
And the fact that we don't care. We care so less that, we won't even put a mask on or get a vaccination to prevent each other from getting sick. And so that tells me a lot about where we are. One last point, because I wanted to put a pin on it, and I'll just start this part of our conversation this way. Sharia law.
Yeah.
Enough said. Yeah.
I always tell people,
what's up with Sharia law, baby?
I'm gonna tell you what's up. First of all, Islam, I'm going to say it right now because I've written it in CNN and said everywhere, and it is true that Islamophobia has become part of the Republican Party ideological platform today.
Right.
For a multitude of reasons. Read the book. I got 416 endnotes, chapter and verse. Like,
yeah, it's there.
But the interesting thing, Michael, to show how, number one, disingenuous politicians are, and number two, how optics matters, is that when Donald Trump was running for president in the Republican primary, there were 16 other candidates in the primary. Right. Every single one of them, from Ted Cruz to Newt Gingrich to Herman Cain to all of them, said blatantly Islamophobic shit. Newt Gingrich said that he thought that Sharia law is a mortal threat to the survival of the United States. Herman Cain said that he would not allow Muslim or Hindus to serve as federal judges in the United States. Ted Cruz has opined about Islamic Sharia law being a mortal threat as well, which is very interesting because the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution clearly states that the Constitution, the American Constitution, and nothing but the American Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land.
Right.
And so what I also said on NBC News Meet the Press is that so when Newt Gingrich or Ted Cruz or any of these disingenuous motherfuckers says that Sharia law is coming to take over the United States, not only should they not be allowed to run for president because they clearly have not read the Constitution, but they should also retroactively fail ninth grade civics class. I mean, how much more of a dunk do you want?
Right, exactly, exactly.
But facts don't matter, as you know. Optics do. It's called heuristics. Heuristics is, you know, is messaging, is branding, is framing. If they can convince enough of the, now keep in mind that because the Supremacy Clause says that nothing, including Sharia law, can trump the American Constitution, Michael, 13 out of 50 American states have already had some form of anti-Sharia legislation on their state legislative books.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I'm sure these were very well researched, studied, and understood laws before around this idea of Sharia law before they were passed.
And it was all boilerplate. It was all boilerplate.
Boilerplate, one state to the next. Correct.
Boilerplate language given by a right wing lawyer and his right wing organization, and basically shopped around. And essentially, you know, given different names like this, you know, Protect Us from Foreign Laws Act or, you know, right. Whatever. I think the Oklahoma one was actually tried to be voted in as an amendment to the Oklahoma Constitution. Like how gangster is that shit? Like, it already violates on its face the American Constitution. But just to make sure the feds didn't get it wrong, we in the Sooner State, we're going to put it in our Okie one. This is my world, man. This is why I got more white hairs than you, dude. You know what I mean? And this is the absurdity of the Albert Camus novel that I've been talking about.
Yes.
And that's the thing, is that, you know, Sharia, it's funny, I always ask people, when people say, you know, what does Sharia law mean to you? I ask them, well, what does biblical law mean to you? Yeah, I always say that if you ask 100 Islamic scholars what Sharia means, you're going to get 100 different answers because it does not mean.
Well, look, dude, you don't even have to do that. Just take your run-of-the-mill evangelical and ask them about the Old Testament. But they're very quick to throw that shit up in your face in a heartbeat, talking about, you know, how they judge this group, that group, how we follow this or that. And I'm like, but don't y'all remember Christ came and changed all of that? We no longer follow the Old Testament. He gave us a New Testament, and he told us, instead of, you know, an eye for an eye, to turn the other cheek. He told us, instead of beating the shit out of the prostitute, embrace her and love her. So what the hell are you, what are you talking about? And it's interesting how these extremists,
yes,
in their political thought,
yep,
have bastardized, and this goes to the question with how some interpret Islamic law, right, how they interpret biblical law, mm-hmm, to meet their own political agendas,
yeah,
which has nothing to do whether you're talking about Moses, Christ, Jesus Christ, or Muhammad. The thread is the same. Love thy neighbor, right? And so this idea that we somehow now find ourselves sitting in on the throne of God in judgment of each other. First off, you're sitting on the throne of God. That's not a seat for you, right? You don't get to do that. And second of all, one of the last things Christ told us before he left this earth is you don't get to judge each other. You don't get to make that choice. You have free will, but understand there is a limit to that. You cannot just go. That's why he said, love thy neighbor as thyself. That's why he said you will always have the poor amongst you. Not because he wanted to make poor people, but the test for us as human beings was, what are you going to do about it?
The prosperity gospel is it baffled me. And that's the thing is that, sort of circling this back to the beginning of what we talked about being men of faith, is that, again, more than anything else, when I get to my deathbed, I want to be able to say that I used my faith for good, right? And that's, for me, that's the key, is that for far too many people in the world today, especially those with influence, they are using religion for bad. And for that reason, religion has a bad rap. God has a bad rap. You know what I mean? Like the level of atheists amongst millennials and Gen Zs and younger, like people just don't, they're like fuck this religion bullshit. And I don't, I see where you're coming from.
I see where you get, I see why you would say from. That. Right.
I can see where you're coming from. But again, I want to I want our grandkids and their grandkids to have our legacies of using it for love, right? Of using it to try to heal the world. As opposed to trying to destroy. Ever since the Taliban took over, we came back. Obviously, I'm getting a lot of calls and interviews and they're like, what do Muslims think? And honestly, my first answer, obviously the not on camera, I was like, first response is these motherfuckers are back. As a global Muslim community, we just put our hands in our face again. We're like, God, I thought we got rid of these dudes. To us, these are the bass-ackwards Muslims of the world, right? These are our January 6th insurrectionists who just happened to take over their capital because it's Kabul and not on North Capitol Street here.
Exactly.
But white people and a lot of Republicans are quick to lump now again the Taliban with everything Islamic and Muslims and worldwide, but then I'm like, all right, then what about white ISIS and Al Qaeda over here with the with your Bible thumping pro Trump insurrectionist motherfuckers, right, who are our American Taliban? Oh no, that's not the same.
No, it is the same. It is exactly, that's cut out of the same cloth. It is exactly the same.
And that's the point. Bigger society is better for good. While we're here is all we can ask to do.
Well, the book is one that I think we should all dig into. It's
kind of be the same, man.
You have not written, a 1,000-page thesis in theoretical, view of.
It's a quick read.
It's a quick read.
I wanted to engage the readers, right?
And that's where I was going to. It's a quick read, but it's a read that engages you. And I want to end, as we began this conversation with your words, you note at the end, we are one. The separation, this intolerance, the secret is that it has not always been this way. Although ideological extremists want you to believe that the West and Muslims are fundamentally incompatible with each other, we should remember that history also teaches us that many of the most important advancements in human history can be traced directly to Muslim innovation and Muslim interaction with other cultures. and end quote. And I would take from that how we move beyond this is exactly through that interaction that men and women of faith, not necessarily religious faith, but of faith in the ideals of democracy and freedom, individual liberties and rights, that you write about and talk about and have so for a long, long time and actually have defended in courts of law and in front of panels and committees as a human rights attorney, as a civil rights attorney, as a global player. That's how we begin to get past through that understanding, through that sense of hope, and through that sense of connection, where we don't use the words of our Quran or our Bible to hurt each other, but rather to connect and understand each other better. And for that, my friend, I thank you.
It is, you know, I've lived in Washington, D.C. for almost 20 years now. And as you know, and I always jokingly tell people that living in D.C. and working in media and politics is, you feel like you're in the seventh rung of Dante's Inferno, right? Yeah. Slaughterhouse floor, it's where the sausage is.
And you realize that there's still some more levels to go that they hadn't written about.
I don't even have access to those. But I want your audience to know two things. Number one, on the interview side of things, that, you know, the key takeaway that we hope you will keep in mind moving forward, you know, is that look at every aspect of your identity. If you're a white male Catholic, if you're a female Buddhist African American, like, think of your own identities, and then think, whenever you hear people say blanket generalizations about any other demographic group, I want you to think to yourself, how would I feel if somebody said that about one of my identities in that blanket way? All Muslims are this. If I'm Jewish or Catholic, hey, I'd kind of hate it if people said all Catholics are pedophiles, right? That shit would get real tiring real fast, right? And there are a lot of Catholics in the media who would kill those stories real quick. We don't got that. I always tell people, you know, jokingly, I was like, you know, if we Muslims are coming to take over America, what gave us away? Is it our three members of Congress? Is it our zero senators, our zero Supreme Court justices, our zero governors? Like, if we were here to take over America, we are doing a terrible job.
Right. Or the fact that, you know, you, none of you run Wall Street. You're not Chamber of Commerce presidents.
No, we don't run anything. But on the personal tip, again, I've been here for 20 years. I've been in the game for 20 years. There are very few people that I have met here in the Beltway, Michael, who have both the intellectual gravitas, but also the kind, empathetic humility that you have. Now, you and I have joked for years.
Right.
I don't know how the hell you were rolling with the RNC and all that. That's fine. Like, I love you. I will love you unconditionally. Like,
that just sounded like my mom.
I know. That actually speaks much higher. I'm like, you're a stronger person than I am. You know what I mean? But it also speaks to your generosity of spirit. And that's the key. And that's the reason, again, you know, 9 days before the 9/11 20-year commemoration, you know, that's why I'm turning down most interviews. When Michael Steele's text message came in, I was like, not only have I not seen your beautiful face in a long time, not being able to give you a hug, but the ability to be able to discuss and synthesize the last 20 years in a way that produces more light than heat, that I want to thank you for, and for being my friend and my brother and a mentor to me. You know, it's an honor to always cross paths.
No, I appreciate that very much. Thank you for the kind word. And the one thing about the way the two of us communicate, we always end our conversations with "I love you," and I do very much
likewise,
with respect and hope and understanding that you bring out of me and what I've learned in listening to you. And I hope that that those who are listening to and appreciating this conversation will take away from it just one tenth of what I've gotten from our friendship over the last 10, 15 years.
I'm honored, and I wish I was there to kiss your big bald head.
Yeah.
I look forward to our next conversation.
And on that note, I think we'll move along. That does it for this conversation with my friend Arslan Iftikhar, author of Fear of a Muslim Planet, Global Islamophobia and the New World Order. I highly encourage my friends and listeners out there to get a copy.
I tell people it's a great cure for insomnia. If you have trouble sleeping, it'll put you right out.
And open your heart and your eyes a little bit to hear what a Muslim American has to say about being an American. I really appreciate his journey and his story. Until next time, folks, you know what you need to do. Take care of yourselves, be well, wear the mask, get the vaccine, and help bring our brothers and sisters along who are still a little bit hesitant. And you know how I feel about those who just want to remain ignorant. Let them be ignorant by themselves. Okay, we can't help ignorant, but you can help yourself. Until next time, take care.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.